The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So in this evening class, this series, we've been exploring topics around the teaching of not self. Last week, thinking about it, one of the ways that we can explore, particularly experientially, how to get at this teaching of not self is to look at places and ways that we identify with self. So to look at how we cling, how we identify with various aspects of our experience. And the Buddha, in his teaching on the five aggregates, which is the teaching that we talked about last week, just in an overview of the teaching of the five aggregates, essentially that's what he's doing with that teaching. The five aggregates is a kind of a teasing apart of various aspects of our human experience. And in particular, the Buddha pointed to those aspects as things that we tend to cling to, things that we tend to identify with. And those five are body or form, physical form, physical experience, feeling tone, whether experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant, the perception aspect of experience, perceiving, recognizing what's happening in experience, and mental formations, the kind of active part of our minds, the emotional mind state, intentional, volitional aspect of experience. And then knowing, consciousness, just the kind of bare recognizing or being aware at a sense door that there's just this contact and a kind of a knowing of there's a sight, there's a sound, there's a smell, there's a taste, there's a touch. Knowing is kind of identified as a pretty basic function of mind. And so after that conversation last week, the question came up about, you know, kind of what holds them together, or the question was, what's the container of the aggregates? And my response last week, as I just kind of thought about it off the top of my head, was that karma, or the process of conditioning, is kind of what holds the aggregates together. The aggregates basically is a description, we could say it's a description of our human experience. There's everything that we experience, whatever part of our experience there is, it falls into one of these five categories. We're either feeling something as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, or experiencing an emotion, or we're recognizing experience. So, and all of these five processes kind of get woven together to create the whole of our experience of what happens to us as a human being. And yet, you know, these aggregates are kind of described as continually coming together and falling apart in this kind of process. And yet it's very much, there's some kind of coherence, right? There's some kind of coherence to experience. I think what I said last time was like, you know, my body and mind processes don't just suddenly disintegrate and then take up residence on the moon or, you know, in another county of California. It's like there's some kind of coherence to the unfolding of this process of body and mind. And likewise, you know, what follows each moment makes some logical sense. There's kind of a lawfulness around what happens. What we tend to have done in the past tends to be what unfolds and what happens. And so hence my thinking about kind of the container that holds or shapes the aggregates, or kind of creates that sense of some kind of coherence to our experience, is this process of conditioning. The Buddha talked about the process of conditioning in a number of different ways. I'll just name a few right now. One, karma. He talked about the process of, you know, when we tend to act out of greed, aversion, delusion, that tends to lead us to suffering. When we act out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, that tends to lead us away from suffering. And so the description of karma is kind of like when we, when our choices, when the processes of mind are shaped by greed, aversion, delusion, that tends to shape suffering in our experience. And when the processes in our mind are kind of more connected to the intentional qualities of love, of compassion, of wisdom, of equanimity, kindness, then that tends to shape things in a very different direction. And so that's one way that he talked about this conditioned process. Another is the teaching of dependent origination, which is kind of a description, one way that the Buddha describes how suffering comes to be. And that description of how suffering comes to be is also the very same process that describes how suffering comes to be, describes how what we think of as self comes to be as well, the sense of identification. And so that's another teaching that I'll probably get to at some point in this series of conversations on not self, is the teaching of dependent origination. But the way that I thought I'd come at it tonight is, again, through the teachings on the aggregates, because one of the five aggregates, one of these five processes of body and mind, is the volitional process. So the process of mental formations. And this, this I talked about last week just briefly, kind of encompasses so much of what happens in our experience, in our minds in particular. It includes the whole terrain of emotional experience. It includes thoughts. It includes beliefs. It includes what we would call mind states, perhaps, but wouldn't necessarily call emotions, like patience or mindfulness or wisdom. These are in this terrain or in this kind of category of mental formations. This is the area of our experience, so the aspect of our experience that has an intentional quality to it. There's a kind of an intention that comes before any action of body, speech, or mind, a kind of an impetus or a motivation to do. And accompanying that intention is some kind of reason why we do what we do. And that that we could call the motivation, but that's also the mental formation in this way of understanding this mental formations aggregate. That when there is a kind of an intention, there's a kind of an impulse that heads that intention in a particular direction, and that might be, for instance, if there's anger arising in the mind, shaping or kind of impelling us to act, then that tends to create conditions for certain things to unfold. If it's love or compassion arising in the mind when there's this movement or desire to act, that shapes things in another direction. And so this exploration of mental formations, I mean, this is a big part of what we explore in our mindfulness practice. You know, it's like we look at what's happening in our experience, and a lot of it is body, a lot of it is physical sensation, but then a lot of it is how we're reacting to what's happening. And that realm of reactivity is in this terrain of mental formations. And so we get to know what's happening in our minds. We get to see these mental formations at work, and we begin to understand how particular mental formations tend to get us into trouble, you know, tend to take us in a particular direction. So when anger arises, it tends to create hostility. It tends to create tension in the body. it tends to create a more aversion and anger, not only internally but externally. You know, we all have experienced when we are in a conversation and somebody expresses something with anger, it's like it tends to evoke it in us as well. You know, so it tends to be, you know, anger tends to shape anger, tends to shape it internally, and it tends to shape it externally. So we start to see how these volitional formations, these mental formations, have an effect on us. When we actually start to look with mindfulness, we see the conditioned nature of these mental formations. One of my teachers, Saido Utejaniya, talks about these mental formations as having a job. He says that, you know, what we need to do, actually, it's really helpful to get to know what the job description of each of our mind states is. So what's the job description of aversion, for instance? In my exploration of this, what I came up with for myself is that the basic function, the basic job description of aversion is to separate me from something. That's its key function. You know, whether that's to get me out of here or to annihilate something else, you know, it's either the anger motion to kind of squash something else, or the fear motion to get me out of here. That basic function of aversion is to separate. So Saido Utejaniya suggested that that's a useful process to explore. It's like what each of our mind states, what its basic function is, what does it do? What does love tend to do? Love tends to connect us, to create conditions of care and concern. So that each of these mind states, each of these mental formations has a particular function, a particular flavor that it tends to operate with. The other thing about mental formations, and I think perhaps you can reflect a little bit yourself, we tend to create pretty strongly senses of self around our mental formations, around these states of mind. They can either be, we can either identify or create a sense of self around pleasant states of mind or unpleasant states of mind. I had some pretty strong identities around unpleasant states of mind, around self-hatred, around miserableness. You know, and it's like amazing that our minds would do this, that it would create an identity connected with unhelpful states of mind. But it's like, well, whatever happens frequently, there seems to be this way that our minds attribute some kind of permanence to that, or some kind of thingness to that. And so in my youth, in my growing up, I frequently experience things from this perspective of aversion and anger and self-negativity. And it happened a lot. And it's kind of like it happens a lot. It's kind of, well, that must be me. That must be who I am. I think it seems to happen in that way. The sense of self seems to kind of arise with things that are familiar, we could say. And so, you know, this is each of the five aggregates actually has a way that it particularly encourages us to identify. And I think in the mental formation aggregate, it tends to be the identification around why we do things. You know, it's like, why do I do things? That's the terrain of the identification with mental formations. Why I do things, and the sometimes the sense of control of the, you know, that I have, I am the one who chooses, I am the one who acts, I'm the one who decides, even, you know, even as these job descriptions, you know, I described the movement of aversion being to separate, that's the job description of aversion. It's like, it doesn't take a me in there to do that separation. It doesn't take a me deciding to do that when aversion arises. That's the tendency. The mind wants to separate. The aversion wants to separate from things. It doesn't need an I or a me in there to say, well, that's happening, let me separate. The activity of aversion has that process. And yet what we tend to do is identify with and think in some fashion that I am the one who did that separation. So there's a lot of selfing that happens in this terrain of mental formations. In the Buddha's description of the five aggregates, there was one particular sutta, and this is kind of how I got to this topic, because at the end of the class, one of you asked if I could offer some sutta references around my reflection on conditionality or karma being kind of the container, or what shapes or makes coherence out of the aggregates. And the key sutta that I came to in thinking about this is one of the suttas in the Samyutta Nikaya. And it's the sutta that describes the aggregates as processes rather than as kind of things. You know, we could look at, for instance, feeling. Often when we explore the aggregate of feeling, we talk about, well, things are pleasant or unpleasant or neither unpleasant. There's an experience there to look at. But the Buddha also describes that process, he describes the feeling aspect of the feeling aggregate, not as the result, not as the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral experience, but as the process that feels the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral experience. And so he describes each of the aggregates as a verb rather than as a noun, as a function rather than as a thing. So it's so in the sutta, it describes each of the five aggregates in this way. And I'm just tonight, in the time that we have, pretty short time we have right now, I'm going to just talk a little bit about the way the Buddha described the mental formations aggregate, because it very clearly points to how this supports a coherence of the aggregates. I will read this section. So in this translation, this is by Tanisaro Bhikkhu, and he uses the word fabrication for mental formation. So this is pointing to the kind of the dynamic nature of mental formations. So that's his translation, the fabrication instead of volitional formation. So that he translates this section of how volitional formation, the process of volitional formation is defined, has described. Why do you call them fabrications? Because they fabricate fabricated things. Thus they are called fabrications. Bear with me, it sounds pretty complex to start, but why do you call them fabrications? Because they fabricate fabricated things. Thus they are called fabrications. What do they fabricate as a fabricated thing? They fabricate form as a fabricated thing. They fabricate feeling as a fabricated thing. They fabricate perception as a fabricated thing. They fabricate fabrications as a fabricated thing. And they fabricate consciousness as a fabricated thing. So basically what he's saying here is that the mental formations are the driver for the shaping of the aggregates. When there is a intentional volitional formation arising, it shapes, because what it's pointing to here is volitional formations create all the aggregates. So as they not only are created, it's like it arises based on something in the past, but it is the tumbling on of the aggregates is because of volitional formation. That's his description of the human being. And so let's just take an example. That's a pretty conceptual description of what it means, what this mental formation means. So let's just talk about anger. Let's talk about what it would mean if we have anger arising. What does anger fabricate? How does anger fabricate form? So how does anger affect the body? Another way to put this, how does anger shape the experience of the body? It tends to create pressure and heat. It may distort the face. It may create tension in the body. That's the body being shaped by the anger. What does it tend to do to feeling? How does that anger shape the experience of feeling? It tends to make feeling unpleasant. It tends to shape the mind that looks out towards perhaps things to be angry about. So it's and which might be looking for other unpleasant things. So that's what it shapes in terms of feeling. What does it shape in terms of perception? Well, this one, in my own experience, I could see, just looking at my experience, that when there was anger arising in the mind, it tended to shape the way I perceived things. And I'll get to that one in a moment. So it tended to, when my attention landed on something, it tended to shape the way I perceived it. So for instance, I was doing walking meditation and I was in an aversive snit doing walking meditation at IMS. And I was walking back and forth and noticing the aversion and noticing how, what was happening there. And I came to the end of my walking path and I turned around and somebody else's shoes were at the end of my walking path. And that, the perception there was, somebody else's shoes, and the reaction was more anger. It's like there was the shaping of that in terms of feeling was that it was unpleasant that I was seeing those shoes at the end of my walking path, and the perception had something to do with somebody like doing this intentionally to, bother me in some way or something. And then the result of that is anger. So right there, that kind of aversive state of mind created shaped the experience of those sneakers as unpleasant as, somebody did that for a certain reason and created anger. So that, so the mental formation of anger tends to shape how we recognize experience. When we're angry, we tend to recognize, it might be, for instance, if we have an aversive state in our mind and we see an expression flit upon somebody's face, we interpret that. We perceive that expression as being somehow an attack on us because we have an aversive state of mind, when all it may be is that they've got a little bit of pain in their gut or something, so maybe just an expression came upon their face. So the tendency that is shaped in our minds by the aversive state is to perceive things as if we were being attacked or as if we were being somehow put upon. That tends to be what's shaped there. And then a consciousness, how does it shape consciousness? So this one's maybe a little more obscure, but when we have a particular state of mind, we tend to see things in the environment. We tend to receive certain aspects of experience and we don't see other things. It's kind of like that we tend to like confirmation bias, that's the word I was looking for. In psychology, there's this understanding that when we look out into the world, we tend to pull out information that confirms what we already believe. And we don't tend to pull information out that doesn't confirm what we already believe. So we're selective. What we become conscious of depends on our mind state. It's not that our sight, our sound, all of our physical senses are not like these bare receivers. They are, what is received by sight, by sound, by smell, by taste, by touch, seems to be shaped by the state of our mind. So this is the kind of the tumbling on of the aggregates. That the, you know, what is arising in our minds tends to shape more things in that direction. This is the Buddha talked about conditionality, as I said earlier, in many different ways. But one of the things he said is it's just a law. It's like a natural law. There's a sutta in which he described it as kind of being like gravity. He didn't use that word, but he used the analogy of a stone sinking to the bottom of a pond. You know, he said if you put a big stone in the water, it's going to sink. He said no amount of wishing is going to make it rise to the surface because that's a natural law. The stone will sink to the bottom of the pond. And he describes the unfolding of this conditionality to have that same kind of quality. It's a natural law. So that natural law of conditionality to me is kind of what kind of shapes our aggregates in a particular direction. And when we see that the shaping of greed, aversion, and delusion, the shaping of reactive states of mind is creating suffering. That itself is a learning, an understanding, a mental formation. So we're not endlessly stuck, actually, in the direction of habits and patterns. When mindfulness enters the equation, mindfulness is a mental formation. Mindfulness begins to shape things in another way. And so the recognition of the shaping of more anger coming from anger, when that's experienced with mindfulness and the suffering of that is experienced with mindfulness, then wisdom that arises with that mindfulness begins to shape things in another direction towards letting go of that pattern that's leading the system to experience suffering. And so the shaping process is both what tends to shape us in the direction of identification, of selfing, of being caught in our habits and patterns of suffering, but it also shapes us in the direction of freedom. The very same conditioned process is described lawfully as leading to freedom. When mindfulness and wisdom begin to enter our mind streams, that shaping starts to take us in another direction, which is a great thing. You know, it's Yeah, it's a great thing. So it's time to stop. I thought I would have a little more time for questions, but I'm happy to stay after a little bit to take comments and questions. And just to say that, you'd asked for some sutta references, and I created a list of them, and I will post those sutta references with the talk. And actually, if you hang out for a little bit, I'll put it in the chat box so that you can copy it and paste it right now. But it'll be attached to the talk, that list of sutta references. And I only really talked about a few of them here today. But yeah.